Flash Notes Podcast, episode number 7, audiobook summary on The Effective Executive by Peter Drucker. Welcome to the Flash Notes Podcast, the podcast for busy professionals that need knowledge now. Brought to you by Flash Notes Book Summaries at getflashnotes.com, where you can get best-selling business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. My name is Dean Bukhari, your host here at the Flash Notes Podcast, where every week we work to bring you the big ideas and actionable insights from some of the best business and self-improvement books out there to help you succeed in life and in business. So tune in, buckle up, and enjoy the ride as we dive into today's episode right here on the Flash Notes Podcast. Hey, it's Dean Bukhari coming back at you with another Flash Notes Audible. Today's Flash Notes audio book summary is on The Effective Executive, the definitive guide to getting the right things done, written by Peter Drucker. Starting it off with a crucial quote: every decision is like surgery. It is an intervention into a system and therefore carries with it the risk of shock. End quote. Quick overview before we jump into the Flash Notes audio. Written by one of the most prolific and influential writers of leadership and management history, Peter R. Drucker, his writing style is clean, crisp, and straight to the point, providing you with the sergeant-like action items on what to do and what not to do in order to be the most effective executive you can be. So what makes an effective executive? Gleaned from his 25-plus year experience as a consultant to the leaders of the world's top business enterprises and nonprofit organizations, Peter Drucker says that the most effective executives all followed the same 8 practices. Number 1, they asked, what needs to be done? Number 2, they asked, what's right for the enterprise? Number 3, they developed action plans. Number 4, they took responsibility for decisions. Number 5, they took responsibility for communicating. Number 6, they focused on opportunities rather than problems. Number 7, they ran productive meetings. Number 8, they thought and said we rather than I. Second big idea, know thy time. Quote, most decisions or most discussions of the executive's task start with the advice to plan one's work. This sounds eminently plausible. The only thing wrong with it is that it rarely works. The plans always remain on paper, always remain good intentions. They seldom turn into achievement. Effective executives, in my observation, do not start with their tasks. They start with their time. And they do not start out with planning. They start by finding out where their time actually goes. Then they attempt to manage their time and to cut back unproductive demands on their time. Finally, they consolidate their discretionary time into the largest possible continuing units. So in case you were wondering whether what you just read above or just listened to above could be broken down into a step-by-step process, well, it can. And according to Peter Drucker, it's the foundation of executive effectiveness. So here's your 3-step process to being as effective as possible with your time. Number 1, you got to record your time. So creating a time log or something of that nature. Number 2, you want to be able to manage your time. Number 3, you want to consolidate your time into the longest possible periods of just uninterrupted work that you possibly can. So the first step toward executive effectiveness, again, is to record the actual amount of time that you're using on a day-to-day basis. Now, it doesn't really matter how you do it. What really matters is that you actually do it so that these days, even though there are, you know, there's apps that allow you to log in the amount of time that you're spending on things and help you to stay on task and avoid doing things like checking Facebook and or constantly checking email. One of those apps, by the way, that a lot of people find useful is an app called Rescue Time. And the best way to figure out, again, where your time is actually going is to log your day-to-day activities in, quote, real time over a period of 4 to 6 weeks. Doing that or doing this will give you a good idea of whether you're focusing on things that are getting you results or if you're focusing on your time on things that are not getting you results. The second thing to do is manage your time. Quote, delegation, as the term is customarily utilized, is a misunderstanding, is indeed a misdirection. But getting rid of anything that can be done by somebody else so that one does not have to delegate but can really get to one's own work, that is a major improvement in effectiveness. End quote. So once you've gotten a good idea of where the majority of your time actually goes, then it's time to identify the time wasters, right? The best way to do that, again, is to look at all of your activities that you regularly perform and ask the following question. What would happen if this were not done at all? Now, once you've identified your time wasters, you want to ask the next question, which is, which of the activities on my time log could be done by somebody else just as well, if not better? And the third and final step is about consolidating your time. Quote, whenever I see a senior executive asserting that more than half his time is under his control and is really discretionary time which he invests and spends according to his own judgment, I am reasonably certain that he has no idea where his time goes. This is true in any organization. End quote. Now, the final and probably the most important step is to consolidate the time that you have available under your control. Because time really is your scarcest resource, and unless you manage it appropriately, nothing else can be managed appropriately. Drucker says that the reason why working late at night at home, by the way, is so popular is actually its worst feature. And that is that it enables an executive to avoid tackling his or her time and its management during the day. So instead of coming home and getting all the work done that you were unable to get done at work, Drucker recommends that you figure out a more effective way to get those things handled. And one of which is to get work done early in the morning. To get it done early in the morning before people begin to call you or before other people wake up or in a closed office or in a bedroom where nobody can access you or bother you, thus allowing you to focus intently on the work that needs to get done. According to Drucker, one of the most effective time managers he's ever met was the president of a big bank who he spent 2 years consulting for. And Drucker says that he used to meet with him once a month, every month, and that the bank president was always prepared for every single meeting. And there was never, ever more than one item on their agenda. And always, an hour and 20 minutes into their meeting, Drucker says that the president would turn to him and say, "Okay, Mr. Drucker, I believe you'd better sum up now and outline what we should do next." And exactly 10 minutes later, he was out of the door. Every meeting for 2 straight years went on like this. And all of them were exactly an hour and a half from the moment he'd walked through the door. So finally, one day, Drucker asked the bank president, he said, why is it always an hour and a half? And the bank president answers, he says, "That's easy. I found out that my attention span is about an hour and a half. If I work on any one topic longer than this, I begin to repeat myself. At the same time, I have learned that nothing of importance can really be tackled in much less time. Furthermore, during the hour and a half that Drucker was in his office every month, he says that there was never a phone call in the bank president's office, and his secretary never stuck her head in the door to announce that there was some urgent or important thing or person that needed to see him either. So one day, again, Drucker asks him about this too. The bank president then says to him, "My secretary has strict instructions not to put anyone through except the president of the United States and my wife. The president rarely calls, and my wife knows better. Everything else the secretary holds till I have finished. Then I have half an hour in which I return every call and make sure I get every message. I have yet to come across a crisis which could not wait 90 minutes. Next big idea, what can I contribute? Quote, the man who focuses on efforts and who stresses his downward authority is a subordinate no matter how exalted his title and rank. But the man who focuses on contribution and who takes responsibility for results, no matter how junior, is in the most literal sense of the phrase, top management. He who holds himself accountable of the performance of the whole. End quote. Bottom line, always be focused on what you can contribute. Always ask yourself, what can I do? And if you're hiring an employee, ask that employee, what can you do for our organization? According to Peter Drucker, to focus on contribution is to focus on effectiveness. People grow according to the demands they make on themselves. They grow according to what they consider achievement and attainment, what they consider to achieve and to attain. If they demand little of themselves, they will remain stunted. If they demand a good deal of themselves, they will grow to giant stature without any more effort than an expended by the non-achievers. That said, here are four basic requirements of human relations when it comes to being as effective as possible with the people you work with and the people you decide to hire on as members of your team. Number one, communications. If you're the type of professional that takes responsibility for your own work, then it's likely that your peers and your employees take responsibility as well. And in order to communicate this effectively to your employees, you're going to want to ask them questions like, what should we expect of you? What are the contributions that we or I should hold you accountable for? What's the best way we can use your knowledge, your skills, your talents? Once you get these answers, you want to let them set their own standards for themselves. Number two, teamwork. Once you have communicated to your peers and your employees the importance of contribution, this then naturally leads to even more communication that makes teamwork a possibility. And there's no organization that is as effective as possible unless it leverages the power of teamwork. Number three, individual self-development. This is all about asking how much you can contribute to your business, to your team, to the company that you work for, to ensure that you are making the most important contribution you can make to the performance of your role. When you focus on asking yourself questions like, how can I best contribute? You're in essence simultaneously asking, what additional self-development do I actually need? In other words, what skills, knowledge, or strengths do you need to acquire in order to make the contribution that you should be making? Number four, development of others. When other people see that you're constantly raising your own standards and constantly demanding more from yourself in order to contribute to the best of your ability, then this challenges them to do the same. By raising your own standards within your own role, you're simultaneously setting a standard of excellence. And that's what it really means to be a role model. Making strength productive. Quote, making strengths productive is fundamentally an attitude expressed in behavior. It is fundamentally respect for the person, one's own as well as others. It is a value system in action, but it is gained, again, learning through doing and self-development through practice. In making strengths productive, the executive integrates individual purpose and organization needs, individual capacity and organization results, individual achievement and organization opportunity. End quote. So let's say you're on top of your own constant, never-ending self-development. You play to your strengths and you allow others to help you where you're weak. But what if you're having a tough time finding someone reliable and effective to help you and or your organization where it's bleeding? Well, for starters, you should know that effective executives never ever hire people based only on personality. They don't hire people based on personality, potential, or promise because none of these are actually measurable. Instead, they hire based on strengths, and they develop their employees based on strengths as well. So how can you staff for strength? By keeping the following four rules in mind. Number one, effective executives never assume that jobs are created, quote, by the nature of God or by nature. End quote. They understand that they've been designed by highly fallible men, right? We all make mistakes, in other words. Number two, effective executives make big and demanding jobs that are designed to be challenging enough to let someone's strengths actually shine and come through. Number three, effective executives understand that they have to start with what a new hire can do rather than what a job requires. They do not focus on weaknesses in their performance appraisals or anything like that. They focus on strengths. Number four, and the final rule, effective executives know that to get strength, one has to put up with weaknesses. To give you a quick aside here and a quick example of this that Peter Drucker talks about in the book, he gives an example of back in Lincoln's time when he was trying to find the right general to lead the army and the military. He basically hired generals over and over again that were weak, that were not fit for the role, and they continued to fail. They just continued to get beaten and slaughtered out there. And so, you know, he essentially hired well-rounded men. He didn't hire generals that were excellent at a specific thing for that specific job. He tried to get guys that were pretty good in every dimension, basically, right? So finally, he realized that this wasn't working, and he eventually hired, if I remember correctly, General Grant. And the problem, the only big issue with him, was that he was an alcoholic, right? And when Lincoln was asked about this, he said that he doesn't really care about how much he hits the bottle as long as he's out there doing his job and he does it better than anybody else. And that was the only successful general that Lincoln actually got on and basically made part of his team. So just a quick little, you know, aside there and an example of, you know, focusing on hiring for the specific job that you're looking to fill, rather than just looking for somebody who's, you know, a jack of all trades or pretty good at a lot of different things. Hire somebody who's specific, you know, who's awesome, who is exceptionally talented at one specific thing that is suitable for that one specific job that you're looking to fill. So again, hire based on strengths. Next big idea. First things first. Quote, if there's one any secret of effectiveness, it is concentration. Effective executives do first things first, and they do one thing at a time. End quote. This might be one of the most profound realizations a busy professional on the grind can make, to focus on one thing at a time. That means shutting down Facebook, turning off your phone whenever necessary, having only one browser open at a time, and closing out the 32 other tabs you've got open in your browser. The list goes on and on. We have no limitation of distractions in the modern world. The greatest gift we can give ourselves is the gift of giving something that's important to us our undivided attention. Real quick, if you're having trouble staying focused, check out the flash notes on The One Thing by Gary Keller. The elements of decision making. So, the elements of decision making. Number one, the first question the effective decision maker asks is this a generic situation or an exception? It is this common human tendency to confuse the plausibility with morality, which makes the incomplete hypothesis so dangerous a mistake and so hard to correct. The effective decision maker, therefore, always assumes initially that the problem is generic. One of the most obvious facts of social and political life is the longevity of the temporary, right? Making things that don't matter and are very temporary a much longer process than it really is. Number two, the second major element in the decision process is clear specifications as to what the decision has to accomplish. What's the result you're after? Number three, one has to start out with what is right rather than what is acceptable, let alone who is right, precisely because one has always has to a compromise in the end. For there are two different kinds of compromise. One kind is expressed in the old proverb, half a loaf is better than no bread. The other kind is expressed in the story of the Judgment of Solomon. which was clearly based on the realization that half a baby is worse than no baby at all. Number 4, converting the decision into action is the fourth major element in the decision process. In fact, no decision has been made unless carrying it out in specific steps has become someone's work assignment and responsibility. Until then, there are only good intentions. So translate whatever decisions you make into action. Fifth and finally, a feedback has to be built into the decision to provide a continuous testing against actual events of the expectations that underlie the decisions, right? So measurables, you want to include things to follow up and make sure that things are going as planned. Next big idea, effective decisions. Quote, a decision is a judgment. It is a choice between alternatives. It is rarely a choice between right and wrong. It is at best a choice between almost right and probably wrong, but much more often a choice between two courses of action, neither of which is probably more nearly right than the other. Drucker says that every decision we make is like surgery. Every decision is an intervention into a system, and therefore carries with it the risk of shock. So how do we make the right decisions? Well, we shouldn't rush the decision-making process. And finally, we shouldn't make decisions without hearing from an opposing party first. And this is really important. That is, we shouldn't decide without a disagreement. Why? Because disagreements force us to look at things differently, from a different perspective, thus stimulating the imagination, and eventually leading us towards the most effective decisions in the long run. Decision making and the computer. Quote, the strength of the computer lies in its being a logic machine. It does precisely what it is programmed to do. This makes it fast and precise. It also makes it a total moron. For logic is essentially stupid. It is doing the simple and obvious. The human being, by contrast, is not logical. He is perceptual. This means that he is slow and sloppy, but he is also bright and has insight. The human being can adapt, that is, he can infer from scanty information or from no information at all what the total picture might be like. He can remember a great many things nobody has programmed. End quote. So, for example, when you click the icon that allows you to download and access this Flash Notes book summary that I've written for you, the internet automatically understands through a pre-programmed series of numbers known as code. It understands that you're a member, thus giving you access to the file, which is stored on my servers, making it available for you and all of our other GetFlashNotes.com members to download and read or listen to instantaneously. Now, imagine for a second if I had to do all of that stuff manually. There'd be no way. I couldn't email each and every single person that subscribed and wanted to download a specific flash note from our library. This is where the decision-making power of the computer comes in handy. It knows when someone is a paid member, so it gives them access, right? It also knows when someone is not a paid member, so it denies them access. Pretty cut and dry. But there's not a set of code on the planet that could write these flash notes in a conversational manner, specifically for busy peeps like you who need to get the essence of a book quickly. This is because computers are methodical, instructional, and exist thanks to long formulas of numbers that have been sequentially strung together to create what we see on any digital screen. Computers don't have emotions. They can't tell the difference between a customer that's happy versus a customer that's totally pissed off. In this context, the only thing a computer can do is tell you that a customer is a customer. Of course, there are some exceptions, none of which happen to be extraordinarily groundbreaking. Take the Amazon approach to customer service. Their systems are designed to make, quote, recommendations based on past purchasing patterns. This is about as advanced as computers can get these days, again, within this context, the context of, you know, online business. Even when you look at, you know, some of the most advanced computer technology that we have available today, the argument that, quote, technology will replace the human hand still doesn't hold up. at least not totally. Even drones require the decision of some pathetic chump of an individual sitting comfortably in a government facility some 6,000 miles away from the target to push a button that demolishes villages full of human beings. The bottom line is this: computers are designed to obey the command of a woman or man. The man or woman is designed to make a values-based decision about how best to utilize this powerful piece of technology. The final big idea here from the effective executive is that effectiveness must be learned. Quote, only effective executives and only executive effectiveness can enable this society to harmonize its two needs. The needs of organization to obtain from the individual the contribution that it needs, and the need of the individual to have organization serve as his tool for the accomplishment of his purposes. Effectiveness must be learned. End quote. So as we close it out, let's challenge one another to be more effective at work, at home, with our friends, with our families, with ourselves, and with one another on a global level. Thank you. If you enjoyed today's episode of the Flash Notes Podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you took just a minute or so to review our podcast in iTunes. And if you're interested in learning more about Flash Notes book summaries, come on over to getflashnotes.com. Again, that's getflashnotes.com. And you can sign up for $1 and get access to business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. Thanks again for listening. My name is Dean Bukhari, and I will see you on the next episode right here on the Flash Notes Podcast.